just as a disclaimer, I am not a expert on this subject. I just happen to be a person who has a personal story of death, and that then led me to this cause. So while I'm an action team leader, because when I found out that Ohio had no one who was trying to work on this, I just stepped forward and said, okay, I'll take that on. But basically, I'm a CPA, so I have no medical background. I want to share with you first my story, and I want to warn you that if I tear up, don't panic. I have been blessed with a lot of support from the hospice facility that, the hospice unit that we used in the aftercare. And it's going to be sad. So don't panic. No one has to try to sweep me off the stage or anything. I'll try to recompose myself and I'll carry on. But I do this because really two things. One is it helps me in keeping, my husband's name was Cliff, keeping his memory alive. And it's also selfish in my respect because I don't want to go through what Cliff went through. So I'm hoping for change so that when the time comes, because it will come, that I will have an option as to how that those ending days, play out. So I had some really good advice from a friend of mine when we were in the hospital, and I'm going to kind of lead up to how we got to the hospital, but a friend of mine who also had a husband who had died of brain cancer said to me while we were in the hospital, Susan, don't let this time go by without having discussed with Cliff his wishes for both how he wants, whether he wants a burial or a cremation, and then even, what would this party or whatever you want to call it, this celebration afterwards look like for him? What would he want? Not so much what you think he would want, but what would he really want? Which was very good advice. While we were in the hospital, we did have that conversation so that when I was asked to make these difficult decisions, Cliff died at 3 a.m. in the morning, and at 2 p.m. in the afternoon, I was at the funeral home having to make arrangements for all of his, what was going to happen. And first of all, I had just done 5 weeks of in-home hospice, so I was a little bit tired. He died at 3 a.m., and I was basically his caregiver, so I wasn't getting a lot of sleep. And then, of course, I was up since 3 a.m. when I found him, and having to make these decisions at 2 p.m. Had I not been prepared, I can't imagine what people go through to have to make those kinds of decisions without having had it, one, discussed with the person who just died, and two, while you're in this highly emotional state and you're just, not able to think clearly. So my friend gave me great advice. I hope that with the work that I'm doing that I can share that experience because, in life it's like you don't know what you don't know. So if you know something, share it. People can listen or they can decide it's really not something that is for me, and that is totally fine. I'm not here to change minds. I'm just here to share a story. So here's the story. So Cliff and I, it was second marriages for both of us. We married in January of 2012, and He's a computer engineer, worked at Nationwide, and he was having difficulty with memory. He did computer languages, and he would write something and come back the next day and not even be able to understand what he himself had written as code. So he started to wonder what was going on. He had just had lens replacement surgery in December in 2013, and here it is January 2014, and he's starting to have these issues. And he really was attributing it to the cataract or the lens replacement surgery that he had. He thought maybe it was some short-term memory issue that was related to the anesthesia. So he struggled through it. He knew something was wrong, but he was looking maybe, you know, he was looking in the wrong place. He went to his primary care physician. Nothing was turning up. Eventually, his manager put him on short-term leave. I'm assuming I've never been told, but I'm assuming he was making errors at work that they wanted to kind of protect themselves and him from, and that he wasn't, you know, going to get fired. So in August of 2014, now he's going through a battery of just tests to try to figure out what's going on. CAT scan did not reveal the brain tumor. He finally went to a neurologist who had him take some memory tests. And I sat in that room with him when he was doing these memory tests. Some he could do really well, but others he really struggled with. So the neurologist sent him off to have an MRI. The MRI then reveals the tumor. So now we're at the end of October of 2014, and he gets a call from the neurologist after the MRI results come, and they say there's a small tumor. You need to make an appointment with a neurosurgeon. The neurosurgeon says it looks operable because it's contained. It doesn't have the legs, the spidery legs that cancer will eventually look like. That it's benign. So, you know, all the kind of the positive feedback that everything could be well. So he goes through the surgery. They slit open his side of his head to get into his brain. It was fortunately at the top level. And he endures the surgery. They do the biopsy, and the biopsy report comes back, and they say, well, it's not benign. There are some aggressive cancer cells that we're detecting. Therefore, we're going to recommend radiation and chemotherapy. So he goes through 6 weeks of radiation and chemotherapy, and that starts to take him down. You know, it's very hard on him. He's losing weight. He went from 215 pounds to 173 at one point. Food didn't taste good, and he just couldn't eat. So back, this all matters because one thing is that Cliff is a DIYer. Cliff says, you know, if something has to be done, he's going to do it himself. He loved taking things apart. He was inventive. He had taught himself many things. He had many certifications in all kinds of computer languages. So he took a lot of pride in thinking and doing and creating. And what this disease was starting to do, obviously it had started to rob him of that even before he went on his leave. He was no longer able to do his work. So while Cliff is going through this treatment plan, he starts saying to me, what would it take to go to Oregon? And I'm like, why Oregon? What were you thinking? And he said, well, you know, they have this thing called death with dignity, and I'm tired of this. I'm not satisfied with the quality of my life at this point in time. I really, you know, would like to have that option of ending it all. I'm ready to go. So this is like in 2015, after he's had radiation and chemotherapy treatment. Moving to Oregon wasn't really a practical thing. He had a son who is still a junior in high school. you know, this is where we live, this is where his family was, this is where his doctors were, this is where his care was. So going to Oregon wasn't really practical. But he did bring it up, and he brought it up several times. We had what we called a new normal life. And honestly, we never really discussed the option that this was going to not end in death. I mean, we just didn't talk about his death. We just talked about how there were certain things he couldn't do anymore, but we didn't really plan for an end that was coming anytime soon. On August 13 of 2016, Cliff turned 65, and that's important. That's an important piece of information because in Ohio, well, it's not Ohio because it's a federal law, but Medicare, if you are terminally ill, will cover all your hospice costs. So we were very fortunate that once he went into hospice, we had very little out of pocket other than to run to the pharmacy to get something that was over the counter. They took care of everything. We had a medical bed, we had a lift, we had all kinds of supplies. All of that was provided free of charge. I don't know what we would have done financially if he had not turned 65 on August 13th, 2016. At that point, we had just in July gone to the Outer Banks, and he was walking and moving around, but his balance started to go off kilter, and he would bang into the wall, and he was getting a bit bruised up because of his lack of control and the imbalance. So on August 13th, for his birthday, we went out to dinner. At that point, I had to help him get dressed and help him cut up his food because he had lost use of his left side on his arm, and he dragged his left leg. But he was walking on his own. That's August 13th. On August 31st, I had to take him over to the James, to the hospital, because he had fallen out of bed. He had been falling for days up to that point, but on that particular day when he fell out of the bed, he was pretty convinced that he had either broken something or damaged his shoulders, and he was just wanting to go to the hospital. So we took him there on August 31st. They admitted him and then basically said to us the tumor had progressed and that there were no options left, and what did we want to do? So we were given a choice. Do you want to go do in-home hospice? Do you want to go to a facility for hospice? Or do you want palliative care? And Cliff very emphatically said, I'm going home. And going home was his only option for him. He was very determined to do that. I, on the other hand, like I said, I have no medical background, thought, how am I going to do this? I'm self-employed. How am I going to take him home and care for him? And so, but that's what he wanted, and that's what we did. And we did that for about 5 weeks. I had been told by one of the neuro-oncologists that he guessed, because they can never tell you, somewhere between 4 to 5 weeks to go to live, because the cancer would eventually reach into that part of his brain that controls the breathing, and that's what would bring the end. But I can't say enough good things about hospice. They came to the house when we called them. They provided us with everything. They answered our questions. They took their time with us. But I was basically responsible for providing Cliff with comfort care through their guidance, of course. And Cliff was on a cocktail of medications to help keep him comfortable. They were using methadone or oxycodone on him, and a variety of other things to Haldol to deal with the agitation. And even though it's prescribed at one every hour, but it also says as needed. So as the caregiver, you're trying to figure out, is it time? I mean, should I be given this? I don't know. It's all very confusing. So we did the best we could. I think Cliff, in the end, one, he was definitely happy to be home. Two, I think even he did ask one more time while we were doing hospice if there was someplace closer than Oregon to go to. And I said, well, there's Vermont. But again, I wasn't really being honest with him because I never did share with him what the doctor had said to me about his 4 to 5 week period. Cliff ended up dying, like I said, in the middle of the night on October 14th, approximately 5 weeks after we had left the James to go home to do hospice. So several weeks after Cliff has passed away, this magazine shows up in the mail from Compassion and Choices, addressed to Cliff. And I thought, that is so odd. Like, there's no choice at this point. He's gone. Like, it just... So I started looking through it, understood a little bit more about what they did. And I thought, I'm going to look into this. And so here I am trying to spread the word on just, one, planning, two, what are the options, my own experience, and three, hopefully one day, just as there are in six other states, perhaps in Ohio, we might have some kind of Death with Dignity Act. Would imagine that you've heard that Charlita Tavares had introduced such a bill before the Ohio Senate, and it's called Senate Bill 249. And I put various literature on the back table. One of them is actually from another organization. I'm going to put my glasses on because I can't read without. there's another organization called Ohio End of Life Options. The founder of that is Lisa Vigil Schattinger. You may have heard her. She was interviewed on NPR's All Sides with Ann Fisher back in, I think it was January, to talk about this subject. At the time that this was being introduced to the Ohio Senate. So Senate Bill 249 basically, and here's, this is just a summary. The bill is actually quite bigger, and you can just go to the Senate's website to get, download a copy of all of this. But basically, what this bill outlines is that, one, it authorizes an adult who has a terminal condition. So it's not going to be for someone who just feels like life is just not worth living. It's about somebody who has no choice. The death is imminent. I mean, this is so terminal condition, and also the capacity to make medical decisions to request a prescription for an aid in dying medication. So that's one, terminal illness, and you have to have the capacity, the mental capacity, to make such a request. You have to make that request three times, twice orally and once in writing, and they actually have prescribed forms where, kind of fill in the blank forms, for the written request. That it permits an individual to withdraw or rescind the request at any time. This is, you might decide one day this is your option and not ever be able to go through with it, and that's fine. I mean, this is not irrevocable. Requesting individual's attending physician is the only person authorized to issue a prescription for the aid in dying medication, but requires the involvement of a consulting physician who must examine the individual, confirm the diagnosis, and determine the individual's capacity to make medical decisions. Also, the individual, a licensed or a psychiatrist or a licensed psychologist would examine the requesting individual before the prescription is issued if the attending or consulting physician makes a referral. There's also a requirement for record keeping as to how many people request and actually use the medication. It prohibits contracts, wills, insurance policies, and annuities from containing certain provisions that could adversely affect an individual's decision to request an aid in dying medication. So they can't write in there that if you choose this option, that payment won't be made. Grants immunity to the person who is present when the aid in dying medication is administered. And designates the bill as the End of Life Option Act. So there are a lot of hoops. This act is really mirrored after, or modeled after the Oregon Act, the Death with Dignity Act that Oregon has, the California Act, the Washington, Vermont has it, like I said earlier, Colorado, Montana, Hawaii just passed the same. Theirs is actually called the Our Care, Our Choice Act. So there is some movement in this cause. Diane Rehm, for those of you who listen to NPR, you may be familiar with Diane Rehm. She is quoted as saying, "After watching my husband John suffer terribly at the end of life, I strongly believe in our right to choose when we die if our illness is beyond any hope of meaningful recovery." She's currently working on a film called When My Time Comes, and this project examines the right to die movement using her own personal story. Her husband of 54 years had Parkinson's disease. His quality of life had declined, his prognosis was dim, and he asked to die. Since there was no legal option, he refused food and water, and it took 10 days for him to die. Also in 2018, so we've got the bill introduced, and also in 2018, we have the passing away of Barbara Bush, who also kind of added to the conversation, I guess, if you will, when she made a very public announcement that she was going to stop all medical treatment and just receive comfort care. Mrs. Bush, or the family's public announcement that Mrs. Bush had decided not to seek additional medical treatment and will instead focus on comfort care. As I said, in January, WOSU All Sides with Ann Fisher had a program, Physician Assisted Suicide in Ohio. You can always go to the WOSU website and you can find a recording of that segment. Another NPR station, 88.5 WAMU, had a program right after Barbara Bush's death called Where to Start with End-of-Life Decisions. That aired on April 19th, 2018. That's another worthwhile program to at least just, if you're interested, for more information and to hear what the various panelists had to say. After Cliff had passed away, again, because I wanted to share what I had learned. I write monthly articles for my own business, and so in January of 2017, I wrote one called End of Life Discussions and Decisions. And a copy of it's on the table back there, but I basically said, the subject of this article comes from my personal experience this past fall with the death of my husband, Cliff. Cliff was diagnosed with brain cancer in 2014. Life took on a new normal, and we had nearly 2 years after his diagnosis to care for the planning, to take care of planning, completing paperwork, and discussing his wishes. Not everyone gets an advance notice like this. Part of why I wrote that too was not only was I dealing with my own grief, but I had a client whose wife also had died, but under very different circumstances. She was a healthy, relatively healthy woman who ended up dying suddenly. And he was sharing with me how he was left having to make these decisions, cremation, burial, all those decisions. And he really struggled because they had never talked about it. And he wasn't sure that his decisions that he made were what she would have wanted. So he really struggled with his decisions because he really had hoped that, boy, I hope this is what she would have wanted, but I don't know. And again, I thought of myself as how lucky I was because I was asked to only really convey what Cliff had said to me. I didn't have to guess. And again, I go back to that friend who said to me, make sure you talk about this. And Cliff and I had time. We don't all know when this is going to happen. We don't have a diagnosis that we're living with for a couple of years. So I go on in my article to say to my clients to make a New Year's resolution to take the following steps, no matter your situation. Make sure you review and complete all your life insurance policies, retirement accounts, annuities, and any other assets in which beneficiaries can be named. It is much easier and faster for an estate to pass directly to the intended beneficiaries when they are named as compared to having the estate go through probate court. Make sure you complete and sign all forms regarding your wishes for continued medical intervention and your instructions as to who will step in to make medical decisions for you in case you are no longer able to do so yourself. Each state has their own form and some require notarization. So I go on just to tell my clients, you know, listen, yeah, I feel this is important, therefore I'm writing about it. I hope you will take this maybe seriously. And as we do sometimes in life, we put it on our to-do list and it doesn't actually get done. So that was something that I had written about as a help for my clients. The Dayton Daily, or the Dayton City Paper, had in their opinion section a debate on, and what they called it, the death debate. So they had two writers, one for, one against any kind of intervention, if you will, in death. They say here that I don't know if anyone's interested in the statistics, but since the Death with Dignity Act in Oregon went into place in 1997, 1,749 people have been granted the prescription. 1,127 have died by legally ingesting those drugs. Just like I said with Ohio, if it ever got passed, part of that requirement is that it's going to be monitored. You may have also seen I thought it was a 60 Minutes report on Brittany Maynard, the California girl, 29 years old with brain cancer, who then chose to move to Oregon because at the time California did not have an act as they do today. Brittany, in an interview with CNN, basically says, "My question is, who has the right to tell me that I don't deserve this choice, that I deserve to suffer for weeks or months in tremendous amounts of physical and emotional pain? Why would anyone have the right to make that choice for me?" Part of what your program said that I was going to talk to you about is this: the terminology here about assisted suicide versus aid in dying. And I do have this handout back there on the table as well. So, what's the distinction? Why why not use the word assisted suicide? So the reasoning is that suicide is not an accurate term to describe the rational and deliberative process that went into the terminally ill person's decision to end their suffering. Suicide is about choosing death over life. A terminally ill person is dying and therefore no longer chooses death over life, but rather one form of death over another. The Oregon Department of Human Services, who oversees reporting of deaths under the Oregon Death with Dignity Act, announced in 2006 it would discontinue using the term physician-assisted suicide and instead use deaths under the Oregon Death with Dignity Act. The American Public Health Association, in November of 2006, passed a resolution recommending using the phrase aid in dying or patient-directed dying, and the American Medical Women's Association rejected using the term suicide. The American Academy of Hospice and Palliative Medicine adopted the term physician-assisted death. So right now, we've got six states, Oregon, who approved their Death with Dignity Act in 1994. It was challenged by the National Right to Life, stalling implementation. Oregon's act was actually a ballot issue and had been approved by 51% of the voters. Because of the challenge, there was a ballot on the issue. It was back on the ballot to rescind the law, but it was defeated by the voters by 60%. In 2002, the Attorney General John Ashcroft issued a directive in 2001 to prevent implementation, ruling against Ashcroft by the federal district court judge. Washington approved theirs in 2008 by a vote of 59-41. Montana authorized theirs in 2008, Vermont in 2013, New Mexico 2014, California in 2015, and Colorado 2016, and followed by the District of Columbia and now Hawaii. These things don't go unchallenged. I think right now California's is again being challenged. The District of Columbia's was challenged. So once approved doesn't really guarantee that those who have concerns about what this might lead to don't try to take that choice away. And so the issues that seem to come up again and again with these as to the concerns about the Death with Dignity Act is, one, unscrupulous family members that somehow they're going to get, grandma take the prescription so that they can get to that inheritance sooner rather than later. But I think, what we can see from the act, you have to have two witnesses, one of which can't be a family member, and then followed by another witnesses. So it's not as if things like that don't happen, but they would try to implement the rules in such a way that to minimize or to keep to prevent that, right? We're aware. Obviously, the religious argument is that that God chooses this living and dying. I'm not here to combat people who have a belief. I guess my only thought to that is, did God already make a decision that this person was not going to live because they have a terminal illness? And it's not It's not a matter of if they're going to die. It's just a matter of when. And then, of course, we've got the Medical Association who struggles with this because of their Hippocratic Oath about first do no harm and the Pledge of Allegiance to uphold sanctity of medicine, patient care, and human life. And is this a violation of that code? So I think that's pretty much all that I wanted to share with you this afternoon. I